The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
So today's reading, it's kind of there for two reasons. One, the David Partlett reading is to introduce to you this book, which is called The History of Board Games. How many of you read the version from Stellar? Okay. Anyone get the book from the library? Because I think it's on reserve. If you really want to print, read like a, you know, hardback paper version, you could just go to libraries and you should be able to check it out, probably from the Humanities Library. So I'm just letting you know that option's out there. One of the reasons is, one, just to introduce to you a bit of what historical research looks like in game studies. There are people who have careers, like David Partlett, who basically go deep into the history of how some kind of game evolved. One of our own alums, Jason Beggy, he looks at railroad games. I'm pretty sure he hasn't changed his thesis topic yet. Okay. And he's been looking at that for like 3 years now, four?
Yeah, 3 years now.
Yeah. And so they'll go to museums, they'll talk to archaeologists. Well, in the case of railroad games, obviously, there are no archaeologists involved. They'll talk to people who worked on, you know, classic game designs, you talk to retailers, you talk to people who actually owned or played some of these games. And I'm wondering if some of the games, you know, a lot of the games that are written in today's reading were kind of, you know, ancient, really, really ancient games. But how many of you feel like you've actually played a game that sounded like one of those that were written up?
Yeah. Well, explicitly they had Dreidel in there.
Yeah, they had the Dreidel in there. That's what, Purim and Hanukkah? Those are the two festivals? Now it's pretty much just Hanukkah? Okay. It's funny because when I was reading about the Dreidel, I was actually, like the initials, the Great Miracle happened there. I didn't realize that there was a different version for if you play Dreidel in Jerusalem, which is a great thing happened here. Which makes sense for Hanukkah, but I don't think, that doesn't quite make sense for Purim, because
that's
just nothing to do with Jerusalem. Yeah. All right. What else? The other games, the stake board games, or the a lot of these games border on like someone setting up shop on the street, and then as soon as the cops come, you know, they run away. That's one of those kinds of games, right? Let's see. What were some of the other things? They had a lot of lots, and one of the traditional Roman implements was the knuckle bone, right? I'm not quite sure if they mentioned what animal it was. I think it was sheep.
Sheep
or goat? Yeah. But that's where the word alia comes from, and alia comes up quite a bit in game studies, at least since Heusinger's time, since I think the 60s, where it's introduced as a generic term to describe games of chance. I think it might also have the word alia might also have been used like in traditional Latin scholarship to describe games of chance. But that's where you get phrases like alia iacta est, which is, does anyone know what that means?
The die is cast.
The die is cast. It's what Julius Caesar says when he about to cross the Rubicon, famously. And there's originally, you know, there was some confusion about whether that meant the die, like the dice, has thrown, or whether that means that the die, as in the mold for something that you put liquid iron in, and then you cast it. But that's only that still has the same sort of sense. Like, all right, it's out of our hands, right? It's already been done. It sort of gets the same point across. But if you actually look at the Latin, it's specifically talking about these knuckle bones, knuckle bones that you're throwing, that which are called alia. So it's really, now it's up to fate. The book makes, Partlett makes an interesting point that in a way, it's a they're trying to simulate something that seems realistic. That even with your best efforts or with your worst efforts, sometimes certain things are out of your control. And clubs simply just describing them as games of chance might be doing them as a disservice, because you see the same sort of like randomization elements come up in computer games in things like combat, right? You know, especially strategy games, where there's like a chance that something may fail, a chance that something may succeed. And when you think about games like war game simulations, they're obviously not trying to create this fantastic, you know, some sort of fantasy element, unless you're talking about things like Fire Emblem or RPG games. But when talking about like World War II games, something like that, they're trying very, very hard to simulate something that's real. And one of the things that they're trying to simulate is that sometimes you just don't have control over everything. And that's where randomization elements, this particular chapter was about dice and the physical things that you use, and we included spinners, we included things that, you know, that were basically binary, and that's actually a cute idea if anybody wants to think about trying to introduce a bell curve to any of your results without having to having people roll a whole bunch of dice. Or if, you know, rolling two dice gives you numbers from 2 to 16, two to 12, but you wanted a different range, you could just have them roll a whole bunch of flat sticks, and then it lands 1-0, 1-0, and you still get a nice bell curve. So that's an idea that you can use in your games as well. Or you can use things like spinners, which pretty much just give you the equal chance no matter which side you land. And you can make a spinner of arbitrary complexity, right? You could make a 20-sided spinner. It'll look basically like a circle, but you could. But one thing that Partlet also introduces is this idea that that games of chance are also kind of like games of imperfect information. Games of imperfect and perfect information, what's the difference between the two of them? It's the first time we're encountering these terms in this class, but anyone want to hazard a guess? What's an example of a game of perfect information?
Like chess.
Chess. And it's a game of perfect information because?
Because all the information that you're going to be using for your decision-making is right there in front of you.
Right. Players see all the game state. Although Partlet then goes says, but then they don't know, and one of them got out the wrong side of bed that morning. Right, you know. They don't necessarily know how experienced each other is, and that's kind of weird. Is that part of the game, or is that outside of the game, right? And other examples of games of perfect or imperfect information?
Go is a game of perfect information.
Okay, perfect. Which one?
Poker would be imperfect.
Poker will be imperfect because you...
You don't know the deck, you don't know what's in your opponent's hand, stuff like that.
Does poker always have to be played with a single deck of 52 cards?
Five decks. You could even not know how many decks there are.
Okay, you may not know. So that's a question too, right? I mean, typically we play it at home, it's just one deck of cards and 52, and if you know that you're holding a king of spades, there's no other king of spades sitting out there. But you play in certain casinos, you know, and they've got a five deck mix. There could be two kings of spades. There's another hand up there.
Poker.
Okay, yeah. And poker is all about trying to figure out what other people have and what's the chances. Actually, you never really know what other people have, but you're sort of trying to read what's the chances that they've got something, plus what's the chances of your hand beating that. And of course, there's all the variants on poker, like Texas Hold'em and everything, which have other kinds of cards that nobody gets to see, that everyone gets to see. So perfect and imperfect information is kind of like a sledgehammer to deal with this, because you're not quite sure, like random numbers or random cards that you're drawing from a five-card stack or random numbers that you're rolling out of a die is a very, very different quality to that piece of information than a card that somebody is holding and not revealing to everybody else, because that's a fixed quantity. It's something that was dealt in the past, and Partlet describes it as sort of past imperfect information. And then there's future imperfect information. You're going to roll it, and then only then is that information generated, even though no one knew it. No one knows that number. So there's a scholar called Celia Pierce over in Georgia Tech. And she came up with a taxonomy just to help her discuss this with her design teams, and I thought it was really, really useful. So instead of saying imperfect and perfect information, we start off with, you know, the obvious one, which is just public information. Games of perfect information are games of where all information is public. Everything is public information. The state of a board in chess or in checkers. There are probably some computer games where this is the case as well, although like multiplayer computer games, but nothing's coming to mind. A lot of computer games take advantage of the fact that everyone has their own screen to do imperfect information. So when you start jumping into the realm of imperfect information, that's private, which is the stuff that one person, at least one person, knows for sure. Possibly, if you're playing on a team game, there's more than one person who knows this information for sure. If you're playing a game like Bridge, where you're sort of communicating but in codes, you know, if you've been playing with someone for a long time, you can get to the situation where even though I can't see your cards, I pretty much know what cards you have because you're my teammate and you're trying to communicate with me in a way that I understand. That's random information. Which is stuff that you get from, say, drawing from the top of a 5-stack deck of poker cards, or something that you get from rolling a die. You know, stuff that you can't really intuit, what Partlet calls future imperfect. Things that will be sort of, for all intents and purposes, that information is introduced the moment you trigger that randomizing method, the moment you throw the dreidel. Spin. Okay. The moment you throw the knuckle bones, whatever it is, that's the moment where the information gets generated. There may be some probability on how you expect this to work out. Like if you're rolling two dice, you expect number 7 to be the most likely outcome, and number 2 and number 12 to be the least likely outcomes. But that information doesn't really exist until the moment it's generated. So what's missing?
So I'll say something. There's information that's like computable.
Mm-hmm.
That's about there. So for instance, when you're playing cards or something like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes technically that like the rules are like you can't see the rounds that have been played.
Right.
But like there's information which, if you were a computer, you would remember this information.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes, when playing in practice, you can't actually remember.
But the stuff that's hard to remember, let me see if I'm hearing you right. So for instance, the game of blackjack to a card counter is a very different from a game of blackjack for someone who sits down and plays for one round, right? Because the game of blackjack for a card counter is aware that this 5-stack deck of cards has had a certain number of cards played out of it. And knowing, being able to remember how much has been played out of it has changed the actual percentage of what could come out. So what's been played before is technically public information. There were previous rounds that were played out in the open. If you were really, really paying attention, you could have seen that information. It's hard to remember, but you could have. If you were a computer, if you're a videotape recorder, you would have been able to see that information. But then there's all the other cards left in this stack that's already been shuffled, and it's kind of in a fixed order. Well, it was randomized before they shuffled it, and then now it's been shuffled and it's just sitting on a stack. That's what Pierce calls hidden information. It doesn't even have to be like a 5-stack deck. It could be just the 3 cards that were dealt face down at the beginning. Is it 3 cards for Texas Hold'em?
Two?
Okay, the 2 cards that are dealt face down in the center, nobody gets to see that until right at the end, I believe. But they're dealt at the beginning of the game, or like in the second hand, or
the public cards?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That's
3, right.
Yeah.
And they're down, right?
After
the first round,
they get
flipped out.
After the first round, they get flipped. Yeah, all right, that's right. That's right, it's been a long time since I played Hold'em. So 3 cards, the face down. But they've been dealt, so the randomizing thing has been triggered. The information is there, but no one knows it yet.
I would argue it's not really different from random information. Like, the difference between, like, I haven't actually dealt the card yet, and I have dealt the card and no one sees it. It seems like hidden information that no one knows.